I'm originally from India, and I came here in 1965, and I applied to a lot of famous universities, and then I thought it really would be nice to go to school in the capital of the country. I did my undergraduate studies in Bombay, or Mumbai as it's known now. And so I thought capital of the country sounds good, and I applied to Washington State University. And they sent me a reply paid telegram and gave me an assistantship, and I said yes, and then I tried to find Pullman, Washington on the map. Some of you may not even know. Anyway, I really want to congratulate Nuke Free Now and thank Kathy and Jay especially. The title of my, I don't know anybody who has done a talk from Pearl Harbor to Hiroshima. And I really appreciate that the sponsors of this conference agreed to let me do the keynote speech. And I say let me do because I helped found, co-founded the Hiroshima Nagasaki Memorial Committee, Commemoration Committee in Washington, D.C. some over 30 years ago with Luis Franklin Ramirez. And so I've participated in these kind of events, but I have found a resistance from those who commemorate Hiroshima and Nagasaki to talking about Pearl Harbor. So every 6th of August, we have this ritual, and I have been less and less inclined to participate in this ritual because one side says the Japanese militarists were horrible and they were murderous, vicious killers, and they bombed Pearl Harbor and started the war, and it was necessary to save American lives. And the other side says the war was essentially over, and it was a message to the Soviet Union, and it's become very ritualized. So 500,000 to 1 million lives would have been saved, and the other side said, well, no, it's not that. And there's some truth to all of these things, and so disarmament folks are afraid to talk about Pearl Harbor, as I have understood. And afraid, I think, fearful is the right, I have had that impression. Because they feel that, you know, if you say the Japanese were militarists, it might somehow justify the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I'll give you a hint of my own position, which I'll clarify at the end, is, had I been here in 1939, I'm not that old, I do not believe I would have had more wisdom than Einstein. Einstein was not only a great physicist, he was a great man and a very thoughtful social justice and peace activist. And he wrote this letter, he signed the letter actually drafted by Leo Szilard. Many Jews from Europe, they looked to Hitler, and they were quite alarmed after fission was discovered. And you know that history, so I won't dwell on it. But I personally, I just want to tell you, me personally, I don't think I would have had more moral vision than he did. He regretted it after the war. He regretted having written that letter. And I'll sort of come to that toward the end of my talk. And then I hope that I would have had the courage of the greatest scientist in the Manhattan Project. And in my lights, the greatest scientist in the Manhattan Project was Joe Rotblat. Joe Rotblat quit the Manhattan Project in early December 1944 when became known from the also spy mission to Europe that Germany did not have a viable bomb project, and so there was no threat from Hitler's bomb, and he felt his job was done, and he quit. But he was the only one. And so you don't know whether you have the moral courage, but it tells you what I wish for myself. All right. I don't want to start the story at Pearl Harbor, because normally it does. I want to make a bigger argument. So I want to get out of this ritual, both for us who want to see nuclear disarmament, and I'm completely with you on that, and have worked for nuclear disarmament for quite a long time. And I also want, especially here, the Los Alamos scientists to get out of their ritual, and the broader society to get out of their ritual. So history did not start with Pearl Harbor. So you have to ask, was the fleet based there since the U.S. conquered Hawaii? What was the U.S. doing in Hawaii? And when did the fleet go there? It turns out that the fleet went there in 1940. It was actually based in San Diego. So that's one sort of pretty big question. The anterior question is, why did the Japanese bomb Pearl Harbor, and did it have a relation to the fleet being there and having been sent there? And what were these two powers doing, dueling each other? They were doing a kind of a complicated kabuki dance for 50 years. So a brief history. After the Meiji Restoration in the mid-19th century in Japan, they started looking out to the world, and their eyes fell on a fellow island nation halfway around the world, which had occupied my country, where I come from. And they thought, this is a pretty good deal. You can get raw materials and cheap labor from others. And like Britain actually has more resources, or had more resources than Japan. Britain had quite a lot of coal, and they could actually fuel their fleet. Japan does not have significant raw material and fuel resources. And so the early project of the Japanese imperialists was, of course, conquest, like all imperialists in those days. And they captured Korea, they waged war on Russia, they won, and at that point they were recognized as a global power by the West. They were big boys. They made an alliance with the British, the Anglo-Japanese alliance. They were actually allies of the British in World War I. Some of you may not know that. And so their ambitions were just as violent. I was going to show you pictures, but they are really too violent. I was going to show you pictures of Japanese imperial violence, of British imperial violence, of the Nazi violence, and the Nazi violence was also, it was the outgrowth of a pathological state that had lost its imperial colonies and was seeking to reestablish them. That's how I understand Nazism. And the whole rightward drift of imperialist powers when they lose ill-gotten resources. The United States, of course, had reached the limit of the continental shores in that same period. And here's a speech that Senator Alfred Beveridge made, a small excerpt of it. I recommend you go to the web and read the whole thing. In the U.S. Senate, January 9th, 1900. So by this time, the Japanese are already significant imperial powers in Eastern Asia. They are expanding. They're about to wage war on Russia. All imperial powers are somehow in China, Germany, France, Britain, United States. Mr. President, the times call for candor. The Philippines are ours forever. You know, this is just after the U.S.-Spanish War. Territory belonging to the United States, as the Constitution calls them. And just beyond the Philippines are China's illimitable markets. We will not renounce our part in the mission of our race, trustee under God of the civilization of the world. And it goes on. you please focus on that last phrase, civilization of the world. It will come back in the nuclear context. Of course, Churchill was occupying the Britain, represented by their very brave Prime Minister, and Churchill is a hero rightly to the British for having saved the British from the Nazis. I completely acknowledge that. But he also did a few other things. He was the, between 1860 and 1920, there were many, many famines in India. Of course, usually there were some meteorological causes, but India was a major food exporter to, and those, any Irish Americans here? So you will understand this best, that during these times of shortage, British continued to export food. And if you see the pictures, it will remind you of another Holocaust, more recent. It estimated by an American researcher who published the pictures, and let me actually use them, they are on our website, that between 30 and 60 million people were killed in famines between 1860 and 1920. But Churchill was not yet involved. But Churchill did preside over a famine in India during World War II, and he refused to let his British people, who said, you have to declare famine and we will do famine relief. No, he wanted all resources directed toward the British war effort, even in India. And here's a couple of quotes from somebody who is legitimately a hero to the British, which I acknowledge, but unfortunately not a hero to me. I hate Indians, he said. They are a beastly people with a beastly religion. And then November 1942, more pertinent. Some of you may not agree with that, I know. I have not become the king's first minister in order to preside over the liquidation of the British Empire. So this will also come back. So in 1931, the Japanese invaded Manchuria, and in 37, they invaded China. You have heard about the Nanking massacres and many atrocities and so on. But there were other imperial powers involved in China. The United States did not like this. They began to put more and more pressure on. Tensions had already been rising. I think the Anglo-Japanese alliance was ended in 1923. You might research my dates before re-quoting them, but I think that's correct. So there are more and more pressure. Japan, of course, completely dependent on foreign resources, has by now got a very big war machine. It's got a big war on its hands in China. It needs fuel. It needs rubber. It needs raw materials. Otherwise, it cannot sustain this imperial enterprise. As the tensions rise, the U.S. is pushing. U.S. is not yet in the war. Americans were very much against getting into the war in 1940. Roosevelt actually did not want to make too much of a point that he really would wanted the Americans to get into the war. There was already the Lend-Lease program and the sharing of secret technology with the British and so on. There was a lot going on. They were de facto allies of the British, of the Roosevelt administration. But he ran for elections more ambiguously. And after elections, there was more and more pressure on the Japanese. The fleet was moved to Pearl Harbor in 1940, actually. I believe it was May or June. And the admiral in charge of the fleet, Admiral Kimmel, said in February, not a quote, that he felt this was a very vulnerable position for the U.S. fleet. His opinion was shared by many military people. It was not a surprise that Pearl Harbor should be a target, even though the date or the attack might have been a surprise. Pearl Harbor was known to be vulnerable, and the fleet was moved despite that. So what was the fleet doing there? The Pacific Ocean for 40 years had been a lake of competition between, especially between the U.S. and Japan, but with Britain being a big player because, you know, the British Empire and sun never sets and all that, you've heard that. British, of course, were all the way up to Malaya, as it was called then, Malaysia today, and the French were eastward of that in Vietnam. So, in August 1941, at a time, so the U.S. was an oil exporter. Did you know the U.S. used to be an oil exporter? And the U.S. was an oil exporter, and Japan got most of its oil from the United States. In August 1941, the U.S. imposed an oil embargo on Japan. So now Japan, the Japanese imperialists, I should say, were stuck. Either they would have to give up the war, or they would have to go conquer some place that had oil. Does anybody know what that place would be?
Indonesia.
Indonesia, you're cheating. We've talked about this. Indonesia. Now consider Indonesia. It's very surreal. So Indonesia at that time was a colony of the Dutch. And the Dutch at that time were occupied by Hitler. And the Americans had positioned the fleet to interdict the Japanese from going to get Indonesian oil, and the Japanese wanted Indonesian oil. Did anybody think about the Indonesians? Okay. So I'm trying to open up the dialogue. I'll tell you a personal vignette. About 10 years ago, the International Criminal Court Treaty came into effect. I wasn't planning on saying this, but I was in the UN on that day when the 60th signature was deposited, and I was actually in that room. And I thought, it's a hopeful day when, in theory at least, still to be given some muscle, that the poorest peasant woman can be equal before a court of law with a sitting president of a country. In theory, we have the instrument. Just like Nuremberg, you know, victory for justice, in theory. We have the precedent. Good. So the Japanese did not want to, Japanese imperialists did not want to give up their imperial enterprise, and they had no other sure way of getting at Indonesian oil and holding it other than getting the U.S. fleet out of the way. Now you know a lot more about Pearl Harbor and what the U.S. fleet was doing there and why the Japanese bombed it. Now I can move on. So it was not a sneak attack in the sense that it was not known, Pearl Harbor, you know, this innocent fleet was sitting there, and some kind of crazy militarists who were prone to irrational violence came and bombed the fleet and killed more than 2,000 American sailors. And not more than 2,000 American sailors. It was a surprise attack to them. They did not know it was coming. I can go on more. There's a lot bigger history. I'm not a scholar in it, so I won't go on. But I can tell you that the U.S. did break the Japanese codes, and they were in possession of quite a lot of knowledge about what Japan was doing. Who all were in possession of what, when? This I will let you research, because I haven't finished my research myself. And you can let me know. Anyway, so the U.S. enters the war. Churchill is totally relieved. He really, really wanted the U.S. to enter the war. And Roosevelt was with him. He also wanted to enter the war. You could say this was a good or bad thing. You know, let's be clear. The Japanese militarists were violent imperialist murderers. They committed atrocities that killed millions of people. We cannot have a discussion about nuclear disarmament if we do not understand World War II, because we will never understand Hiroshima If we are not courageous enough, we cannot be afraid to say, I, as an ancient, have absolutely no problem. The Japanese actually had a little bit of connection with that famine in Bengal because they were all the way into Burma. I won't go into the connection. I'll leave that as a question for you. There's a book by I forgot her first name, but her last name is Mukherjee, called Churchill's Secret War, about that famine. It's a very brilliant book. I recommend it to you. So, Churchill really wanted American help. At that time, the Soviet Union had already been attacked. So let me set a little bit more of the stage until the first decision to target Japanese forces. The Soviet Union, Operation Barbarossa, June 22nd, I think, 1941. So now, Germany, Soviet Union are no longer, you know, in this non-war state at the time of Pearl Harbor. They've already been fighting for 6 months. So the Soviet Union, the United States, and Britain become allies. France is in that odd position. There's some resistance. De Gaulle, I think, I don't know when De Gaulle was in London. But mainly Britain, U.S., and Soviet Union became allies from that time on. Now, the United States already had the whole anti-communist posture, as did Britain. They really did not want the Soviet Union in Europe. General Marshall, who was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, I don't know if Joint Chiefs was called that then. Anyway, he was the head of the U.S. Armed Forces. He recommended, as did most other senior military officials, and I believe with them, I have some text in that regard, that the U.S. should invade Europe in 1942. I believe the suggested date was September. Churchill did not like. He wanted to make sure the Suez Canal was open. Remember the quote I read to you. I promise you this is all connected. My wife thinks I go on with stories, but she also recognizes after 38 years of marriage that it is all connected. Sometimes it takes long. So he insisted that the North African campaign be conducted first. 1943, it was the same thing. Meanwhile, Stalin and the Soviet Union are fighting the bulk of the war. Stalin is asking for help. He went so far as to tell the British that if you can't invade Europe from the West, at least send us some troops. You can come and fight on Soviet soil. He was inviting British troops to go and partly occupy Soviet soil to come and fight, and Churchill said no. So at the time of Operation Overlord, note the name, June 1944, the Americans were facing 27 divisions, 29 divisions, when the D-Day landings took place. And the Germans had 81 divisions in the West, on the Western Front. The Soviets were fighting 250 divisions, of which I believe 180-odd were German divisions. The rest were Eastern Europe, Romanian, and so on. So that was the situation. Now the bomb project has started. Now we can insert the bomb project into this canvas. On October 9th, 1941, Vannevar Bush, how many have heard of Vannevar Bush? This is sad, because he is the principal architect of my story. He was the head of, no relation to the later Bushes, so far as I know. He was the head of the office. He came from MIT, was an engineer, electrical engineer, I believe, and great inventor, very well established New England. He was a New England establishment man. like his colleague, James Conant, who had been president of Harvard, I think, and a chemist. And Vannevar Bush was the head of the Office of Scientific Research and Development in Roosevelt's White House. He was in charge of the development of new technology for the war. Initially, I think he was not very sympathetic to this thing, that Hitler will get the bomb. He had one goal, that the Pentagon does not have enough scientific resources for the United... This is before the U.S. has entered the war now. This is 1940. U.S. should have more military muscle to be present as a dominant power on the world stage. This is his goal. He felt that academic scientists should be brought into this enterprise. Academic physicists were nowhere in the military enterprise in this country. They had been in Britain. From the Royal Society, and physicists were very close from the birth of the Royal Society. You can read Lewis Mumford about that. He has written wonderfully about this subject. But not here. When the U.S. government, to give you a vignette of where physics was in 1939, the U.S. government offered money, small amount of money, I don't remember the sum, to do nuclear reactor research after fission was discovered. This was in 1939 that the money was offered. The physicists found it really weird, university physicists, that the government was offering them money. And they refused. This was not long ago. By the end of 1940 or 41, I think half the physicists were already getting money from the Office of Scientific Research and Development. They had a pretty big budget, this office. Bush didn't like the idea of the Manhattan Project. It wasn't called that then. Because his goal was that academic scientists should not be seen as eggheads dreaming things for the next war, but that they should develop things for this war. He didn't think that fission bombs would make it. He was finally convinced by people that this is serious. We cannot let Hitler get the bomb first, so he signed on. But it's my view, and this is so you can develop your own view, I invite you to do so, and if you don't agree, I would like to know. But my view, I will tell you where my research is softer than other places, because not as widely supported. That on October 9, 1941, when Bush, this is almost 2 months before Pearl Harbor now, we have started what became the Manhattan Project. When Bush signed on to it, the use of the bomb was already decided, because his whole goal was that whatever he's going to spend a lot of money on has got to be used in this war. Fast forward. Project has started. You know many of the details, and they are easy to find. An executive committee was established for the Manhattan Project. Do you know that not a single general responsible for World War II was on this executive committee? Not one. In fact, most generals who were prosecuting the war had no clue about the Manhattan Project. They did not know it existed. They were not told. Even Admiral Leahy, who was Roosevelt's liaison with the Joint Chiefs of Staff, with the generals in the Pentagon, and Leahy worked in the White House, he found out by accident when Lord Cherwell, who was Churchill's science advisor, was visiting Roosevelt in 1944, and Cherwell could not imagine that Leahy would not know about the bomb project, and he talked about it. That's how Admiral Leahy found out. MacArthur was informed by memo on July 30th, I believe, 1940, what do you think? July 30th, 1945, that this bombing was going to take place. He also had no clue. The list is pretty long. The people on this committee chair was Vannevar Bush. He had James Conant, so two scientists. They didn't let any of the other scientists know anything of what I'm going to tell you. So they were supposed to be representing the scientists, or so the scientists may have thought. General Groves, of course, who was the executive director of the Manhattan Project, effectively. And then there was another general who was part of the construction side of things, like Groves, General Steyer. And there was an admiral, Admiral Pernell, who was in charge of new weapons in the Pentagon. There wasn't a single general. There was no liaison with what was going on in the war. So nuclear weapons are already detached from the war effort. May 5th, 1943. Will you promise to help me make this date famous? May 5th, 1943. And today there are two reasons to make it famous. Because all the reactors in Japan were shut down on May 5th, 2012. I wrote about it, actually. I told them, make this date a better date than it is for you so far. May 5th, 1943, the Military Policy Committee met to review the progress of the project. The last paragraph in the minutes relates to targeting, and I believe it was the first targeting decision that was ever made. Here's the last sentence, I think, in that. So they decided to de-target Germany. They decided they were not going to target Germany. It wasn't because of race. Race had nothing to do with it, so far as I can tell from this and other research. Race did not enter into the targeting. There was a lot of racism against the Japanese. Of course, you know that. We know that. There were all the internment camps and so on. But race did not. Plutonium was race-free, as it turned out. The Japanese were selected for targeting. This is a quote. As they would not be so apt to secure knowledge from it. The it refers to the bomb in case it is a dud. So the whole reasoning was, what happens if the bomb is a dud? So the Japanese would not be so apt to secure knowledge from it as would the Germans. So the Germans at Heisenberg. It was not a racist thing. It was a good evaluation. So from May 5th, 1943 to the bombing of Japan, Germany was never targeted. It was not. There is no evidence to that fact. Churchill and Roosevelt, when they met in 1944, actually Churchill said something like, after mature consideration, we might use the bomb against Japan. Churchill did not, so far as I know, ever raise the question of the bomb being used in Europe against Germany. When Truman became president after Roosevelt died, Truman did not, as vice president, did not know about the Manhattan Project. In fact, he has written a threatening letter as a senator that you're spending all this money in 1944. If you don't let me investigate it, and they didn't, there's going to be some price to pay if I discover race, fraud, and abuse, which is still a common phrase. We're still waiting to discover it, right? So Groves briefs the president in April 23rd, I think, 1945, and he tells the president, the target is and was always expected to be Japan. I interviewed many of the leading scientists. So this has been in the fine print. So I wasn't the first to discover this. So these memos have been declassified. This has been written about in the official AEC history of the war, and first in the 1960s of the Manhattan Project. But I do think I can claim to be the first to see the significance of this. So I interviewed the scientists in an article I wrote for the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. So I called up Robert Serber, who worked with Oppenheimer. I called Joe Rotblat. I was privileged to know Joe. And I called up Glenn Seaborg for separate plutonium. I called up Hans Bethe, the director of the theoretical division in Los Alamos during the war. Good people. Not a single one of them knew in 1995 They all believed the bomb was used in Japan because the war was over too soon in Germany. They were surprised that Germany had been detargeted in 1943. So, now Joe Rotblat's decision to leave assumes a greater significance. But think that if you have contributed to the destruction of two cities, how much curiosity should you have about what went into the decision? This is an important question I would like to ask Los Alamos scientists. So, we know the sequence to the bombing of Hiroshima. Now in 1944, the United States is looking to the end of the war. Dean Acheson was the Secretary of State. Do you know what his memoir was called? Present at the Creation. He testified to Congress in 1944. You could probably fix it so that everything produced here would be consumed here. Mark these words. That would completely change our Constitution, our relations to property, human liberty, our very conception of law, and nobody contemplates that. Therefore, you must look to other markets, and those markets are abroad. Enter the nephew of Henry Stimson, the Secretary of War. The nephew of Henry Stimson, Alfred Loomis, was a Wall Street banker, an amateur physicist, who had a mansion in a place called Tuxedo Park, north of Manhattan. And many of the famous physicists passed through Tuxedo Park, and the invention of radar started in his basement. Fermi went there, Lawrence went there, Niels Bohr went there. He's one of the most colorful characters in American history. He sold all his stocks in 1928. He sold Simpson stocks for him, too, and saved his uncle's fortune. And later on, he bought them up on the cheap. So he was a brilliant banker. Loomis sent, I think it was Loomis who sent a note to his uncle saying in early 1945, look, the Soviets are occupied a good bit of Europe. 200 million people are in that part of Europe. We're going to lose those markets to socialism. So he writes this long memorandum. Let's compromise with the Japanese so that the Soviets don't enter the war in the East and occupy China and Japan, and we lose those markets too. And so let's give up unconditional surrender, and so let's give the Japanese Korea, you know, let's throw something nice to the imperialists and give up on unconditional surrender, and so the Wall Street will come out well. And by the way, I think 500,000 to 1 million lives would be saved because American soldiers wouldn't be forced to fight the war to the end. So now you know where that number first came from. So Stimson sent this to General Marshall and said, give me your review of this. General Marshall sends it off to his general staff, and they give him a view of this. General staff sent back a note saying, we don't think we should give up on unconditional surrender, and we think that the estimate of 500,000 lives saved by not invading Japan is, quote, entirely too high. Okay. General Marshall forwards the Stimson policy is maintained. Now come July 1945. The Japanese are at the end of their rope. Their cities are being firebombed. Their supplies are cut off. Their people are starving. Their soldiers who are out, you know, in the far posts have little to eat. Of course, the fuel and logistics are in complete disarray. The war was essentially over 6 months before that, at least. The Japanese are wanting to surrender, but they want their emperor to stay. the Japanese militarists, this is a Japanese, when I say Japanese, I mean the Japanese ruling class. Nobody consulted the public. The Japanese, for the Japanese ruling class, the emperor staying was more important than the lives of the people. Between the Potsdam Declaration, when they said unconditional surrender, and the bombing of Hiroshima, I think 10,000 people died in fire bombings. Now, they said emperor must stay. This message was conveyed by the Soviets, who were not yet in the war, to the Americans. Americans replied, unconditional surrender, no deal. Americans, of course, at this time also had broken the code of the Japanese, and they knew all of this. The Soviets didn't have to tell them that. Japanese did not know. Meanwhile, the bomb is ready. MacArthur has been informed. And it is used on the first day that the weather permits. So this is very important. As important to understanding, as important as everything else, is the fact that the bombs were used as soon as they were ready. First bomb on August 6th, second bomb on August 9th. First clear weather day. Actually, the target was not even clear weather for the second bomb. Nagasaki was kind of picked up as a target. It was not on the original preferred target list. It had already been, because it had already been damaged by prior bombings, and they wanted, there was an experimental aspect to these bombings. It was not the main aspect, but there was, they wanted to know what bombs would do on undamaged cities, and some cities had been named as not to be bombed. Do not bomb with napalm and things like that. The Soviets entered the war just before the bombing of Nagasaki. What happened in Japan on August 6th? Of course, they knew this time is up. But so far, now I'm not as this debate, the next 9 days have an immense debate around them. The best that I can tell is they knew time is up. They knew this is a new weapon. Americans have said we will use this repeatedly, I believe, after, I think Truman said that. The Japanese still want the emperor to stay. They still are not ready for unconditional surrender. The Soviets enter the war. This is a big shock because the Japanese are still hoping that the Soviets will mediate a surrender with appropriate conditions. Soviets enter the war. Truman has said, before the bomb test, I think, in his diary, that Soviets enter the war, Japan will surrender. That was his view. But after the bomb test, the U.S. actually did not want the Soviet to enter the war because of what I have told you. The idea was we should keep, you know, the markets. The invasion of Japan. So Okinawa has been conquered and things have been stopped at that point because the next step is very big, to the invasion of Kyushu, the southern main island of the southern island of the main part of Japan. And this they knew would be a very big deal. And so it was not due to start till November 1. Now we're in August, September, October. So almost 3 months. Now, with the opinion, so here's what totally convinced me that the bombings are completely illegitimate. Now I have told you what I think. Is because they themselves believed that the Soviet entry may precipitate the surrender. And there is no price for the Americans to wait for 10 days. No price. Soviets could not have occupied a big area in a day, right? It takes time to move those armies. But they decided to use the bombs. And the second bomb was used also as soon as. In the end, the Americans apparently covertly agreed to let the emperor stay. So the emperor of Japan and the elite of Japan, even after two atomic bombings, did not care enough of their own people to agree to unconditional surrender terms. This is a very important thing to know about the Japanese militarists. So if you think that Americans are responsible for that decision, and I think they are, because it was their bomb and they decided to use it, you have to think who was in charge in Japan. This is very important for us to acknowledge. This will start a conversation in the United States. And I want a broader conversation to start. I have done this in the panhandle of Texas, in the home of farmer friends. And my farmer friends in the panhandle of Texas said, let's go and get rid of nuclear weapons. Let's get children out of the way of war. That's why I'm bringing you this message, because I am convinced that this message is more truthful. And I see Gandhi t-shirts here. I admire Gandhi most for two things. And there are things I'm very critical of Gandhi, as an Indian especially. The different story, the bringing of truth into politics. That's why I regard him as the greatest political person in history. And he said process is the central ingredient of the, if you want a good result, you gotta have a good process. We haven't had a good process so far because we have not acknowledged the truth in the other side. All right. A couple of other things. So I promised you I would bring civilization back into this picture. When Stimson briefed Truman after he became president, April 1945, here's what he told Truman. If the problem of the proper use of this weapon can be solved, we would then have the opportunity to bring the world into a pattern in which the peace of the world and our civilization can be saved. All right. Now you must reflect on the character of the civilization and those pictures I did not show you. You can come and see them. They are in my computer. Here, in Los Alamos, on August 6th, Richard Feynman, a great physicist, and I believe in 1980 became a greater man. He, remembering August 6th, he said this. The only reaction I remember, perhaps I was blinded by my own reaction, was a very considerable elation and excitement. And there were parties, and people got drunk, and it would make a tremendously interesting contrast what was going on in Los Alamos at the same time as what was going on in Hiroshima. I was involved with this happy thing, and also drinking and drunk and playing drums, sitting on the hood of a bonnet of a Jeep and playing drums with excitement, running all over Los Alamos at the same time as people were dying and struggling in Hiroshima. This was an interview with the BBC, I think around 1980. And then he reflects further. With regard to moral questions, I do have something I would like to say about it. Because the original reason to start the project, which I had, was that the Germans were a danger. All kinds of attempts to redesign and make it a worse bomb or whatever, and so on, and all the working, and all working all the time to see if we could make it go. But what I did, immorally, I would say, was to not remember the reason that I said I was doing it. So that when the reason changed, which was that Germany was defeated, not the singlest thought came to my mind at all about that. That meant now I would have to reconsider why I am continuing to do this. This is the next sentence from one of the most brilliant physicists in the 20th century, which was full of brilliant physicists. I simply didn't think, okay? That's what he said. Now, I think the people who repeat this thing about 500,000 to 1,000,000 lives saved, I would bet the vast majority of them have no clue where it came from. They also don't know what the general said, which is something between 20-odd thousand American lives would be lost, and 46,000, I think. And they had various scenarios for the war. And the worst-case scenario did include suicide bombings from aircraft and kamikaze tactics and all that. They knew what they were doing. The people who say, you know, the Japanese were vicious militarists, which is true. I have Japanese elites. Have they done a calculation? Are they going to go into the shoes of the military? There's actually cable correspondence after the war when somebody said 200,000, I believed it was Henry Stimson, that should we correct the Secretary of War because the estimate was tens of thousands. And the overall decision was don't get mixed up in it and give the Japanese a propaganda advantage. And then Truman wrote 250,000 in the first draft of his memoir, and then he felt it wasn't good enough. And in the final version, which was published, he said, and I believe this is pretty close to an exact quote, "General Marshall told me that 500,000 lives would be saved. And I have just told you what General Marshall forwarded during the war to the president." And Truman was president in June, that contained a slip from the staff evaluation saying that estimate was entirely too high. Now, I don't know what General Marshall had whispered at some dinner to Mr. Truman. I wasn't there. But I can give you some facts that throw some doubt on this assertion. I really want to enter into a conversation with Los Alamos scientists about this, because they are wedded to the bomb by habit. They are wedded to the bomb because, as Mr. Truman is supposed to have said, I don't know whether he actually said it, but I have credited President Truman with being the greatest physiologist of the 20th century, because he said that the most sensitive nerve in the human anatomy runs through the pocketbook. He was a wonderful man. And I actually have reflected a lot on this, and I think all of us have rerouted, all of us who live in civilization, and this is part of the character of civilization, have rerouted our entire sensory systems through our pocketbooks. Of necessity, I'm not condemning it. I'm saying if you want to extract yourself from the worst moral consequences of the kind of civilization we live in, then we must recognize the truth of this. I don't think Los Alamos scientists will listen to me, but I hope that they respect Richard Feynman. I would not put Richard Feynman on the same plane as Joe Rotblat, who is the only hero scientist in my book. Well, there was Leo Szilard, who started the thing and tried to stop the bombing and went to Jimmy Burns, who was Secretary of State, and said, really, don't do this. And one of the main reasons for dropping the bomb, and I'll stop here, was that the expenses on this project needed to be justified. Groves has said, and this is a paraphrase, that if the project is seen as a success, we will be celebrated. If it is seen as a failure, Congress will investigate nothing else. I think he even joked that he might have to get an apartment near Capitol Hill because he'd be testifying all the time. So this was a dominant reason for the rush. But I believe those who have said it was a message to the Soviets and the world are also right, because Groves has said, the bomb project was carried out with the idea that the Soviets were the enemy. It's interesting, so many vignettes. DuPont ran Hanford, where the plutonium was made for the Nagasaki bomb. DuPont had been, prior to the start of World War II, quite close to some of the infamous, at least one or two of the infamous companies. And they weren't alone, of course. There were many American companies that had close ties to companies that later became infamous. But do you know that Groves thought that he didn't have the time to investigate DuPont and their fascist connections, and that he would trust their patriotism to do it right? At a time when they kept the Manhattan Project secret from all but a handful of members of Congress, and I do not believe even a handful of the actual leaders who were responsible for the conduct of the war. So let me recommend Gandhi to you in maybe a new way, my way of thinking about Gandhi. And as you know, I call myself a critical Gandhian, and sometimes very critical. You don't know this because you are here, and Gandhi was India's gift to the world. What he was to India is more complicated. I'm a child of the partition, so I have to think that more carefully about what happened in India and what the role of various parties was. But I will leave you with this, that our side, who wants disarmament, has been, not everybody, has been a little afraid of the truth. As a result, we have been painted into a corner that the right wing may well call the dump on America crowd. You know, often called that. And I would say if we reflect on it really honestly, you have to say that giving such a one-sided view of what happened in World War II lets too many parties off the hook, including the Americans. Because if you don't ask what the fleet was doing in Pearl Harbor, you'll never understand about oil. Or the Indonesians. So if we want disarmament, we must be bolder and start a more respectful conversation. I'm not saying, you know, all the things, actions that are planned shouldn't be done. What I'm saying is we need a better conversation with Los Alamos, and we need a better conversation with the American public. I'm convinced that nuclear weapons have become today, from a high-tech instrument, a monopoly of the most powerful in 1945, to an instrument of terror of North Korea, which is an impoverished state with lots and lots of hungry people. It has become an instrument of response of the poor dictators who want to terrorize others instead of the instrument of domination of the rich who want to terrorize others. And nuclear weapons were built. The whole of air warfare was designed as a warfare of terror. It's a next talk. But please take this away. Process is very important, and we must not forget Pearl Harbor nor Hiroshima. We must understand both things. And we must bring more of the truth to Los Alamos and the country than we have, because the other side isn't going to do it. Right? You know, the nuclear power companies aren't going to rush and say, let's have a carbon-free, nuclear-free economy. Are you seeing them rushing? They say, well, let's put solar on the table, let's put nuclear on the table, let's have a smorgasbord of energy, and we'll all be happy. So let's do that. Thank you very much for letting me do this and inviting me.